Side 5, Mona Lisa Overdrive, by William Gibson. Continuing on page 123. Come along, then, Petal said to her, releasing his grip on the dark worsted lapel. You'll just want to say hello. They found Swain seated at a 3-meter oak refectory table in the room where she'd first seen him. The dragons of rank buttoned away behind white broadcloth and a striped silk tie. His eyes met hers as she entered, his long-boned face shadowed by a green-shaded glass reading lamp that stood beside a small console and a thick sheaf of facts on the table.
Good, he said. And how was the sprawl?
I'm very tired, Mr. Swain. I wish to go to my room.
We're glad to have you back, Kumiko. The sprawl's a dangerous place. Sally's friends there probably aren't the sort of people your father would want you to associate with.
May I go to my room now?
Did you meet any of Sally's friends, Kumiko?
No.
Really? What did you do?
Nothing.
You mustn't be angry with us, Kumiko. We're protecting you.
Thank you. May I go to my room now?
Of course. You must be very tired.
Petal followed her from the room, carrying her bag, his gray suit creased and wrinkled from the flight. She was careful not to glance up as they passed beneath the blank gaze of the marble bust where the Mass Neotech unit might still be hidden, though with Swain and Petal in the room she could think of no way to retrieve it. There was a new sense of movement in the house, brisk and muted. Voices, footsteps, the rattle of the lift, the chattering of pipes as someone drew a bath. She sat at the foot of the huge bed, staring at the black marble tub. Residual images of New York seemed to hover at the borders of her vision. If she closed her eyes, she found herself back in the alley, squatting beside Sally. Sally, who'd sent her away, who hadn't looked back. Sally, whose name had once been Molly, or Misty, or both. Again, her unworthiness. Sumida, her mother adrift in black water. Her father, Sally. Moments later, driven by a curiosity that pushed aside her shame, she rose from where she lay, brushed her hair, zipped her feet into thin black rubber toe socks with ridged plastic soles, and went very quietly out into the corridor. When the lift arrived, it stank of cigarette smoke. Red Face was pacing the blue-carpeted foyer when she emerged from the lift, his hands in the pockets of his tight black jacket.
"Here," he said, raising his eyebrows. "You need something?"
"I'm hungry," she said in Japanese. "I'm going to the kitchen."
"Here," he said, removing his hands from his pockets and straightening the front of his jacket. "You speak English?"
"No," she said, and walked straight past him, down the corridor and around the corner.
"Here,"
she heard him say, rather more urgently, but she was already groping behind the white bust. She managed to slip the unit into her pocket as he rounded the corner. He surveyed the room automatically, hands held loosely at his sides, in a way that suddenly reminded her of her father's secretaries.
"I'm hungry," she said in English.
5 minutes later, she'd returned to her room with a large and very British-looking orange. The English seemed to place no special value on the symmetry of fruit. Closing the door behind her, she put the orange on the wide flat rim of the black tub and took the Mass Neotech unit from her pocket. "Quickly now," Colin said, tossing his forelock as he came into focus. "Open it and reset the AB throw to A. The new regime has a technician making the rounds, scanning for bugs. Once you've changed that setting, it shouldn't read as a listening device." She did as he said, using a hairpin.
"What do you mean?" she asked, mouthing the words without voicing them. "The new regime."
"Haven't you noticed? There are at least a dozen staff now, not to mention numerous visitors. Well, I suppose it's less a new regime than an upgrading of procedure. Your Mr. Swain is quite a social man in his covert way. You've one conversation there, Swain and the deputy head of special branch, that I imagine numerous people would kill for, not least of them, the aforementioned official."
"Special branch? The secret police. Bloody odd company he keeps, Swain. Buckhouse types. Czars from the East End rookeries. Senior police officers.
Buckhouse?
The palace. Not to mention merchant bankers from the city. A thin-stim star. A drove or two of expensive panders and drug merchants.
A Simstim star?
Lanier. Robin Lanier.
Robin Lanier? He was here?
Morning after your precipitous departure. She looked into Colin's transparent green eyes.
Are you telling me the truth?
Yes.
Do you always?
To the extent that I know it, yes.
What are you?
A mass neotech biochip personality base programmed to aid and advise the Japanese visitor in the United Kingdom. He winked at her.
Why did you wink?
Why do you think?
Answer the question,
her voice loud in the mirrored room. The ghost touched his lips with a slim forefinger. And something else as well, yes. I do display a bit too much initiative for a mere guide program. Though the model I'm based on is top of the line, extremely sophisticated. I can't tell you exactly what I am, though, because I don't know.
You don't know?
Again, subvocally, carefully. I know all sorts of things, he said, and went to one of the dormer windows. I know that a serving table in Middle Temple Hall is said to be made from the timbers of the Golden Hind, that you climb 128 steps to the walkways of Tower Bridge, that in Wood Street, right of Cheapside, is a plane tree thought to have been the one in which Wordsworth's thrush sang loud. He spun suddenly to face her. It isn't, though, because the current tree was cloned from the original in 1998. I know all that, you see, and more, a very great deal more. I could, for instance, teach you the rudiments of snooker. That is what I am, or rather what I was intended to be, originally. But I'm something else as well. And very likely something to do with you. I don't know what. I really don't.
You were a gift from my father. Do you communicate with him?
Not to my knowledge.
You didn't inform him of my departure?
You don't understand, he said. I wasn't aware of your having been away until you activated me a moment ago.
But you've been recording.
Yes, but not aware of it. I'm only here when you activate me. Then I evaluate the current data. One thing you can be fairly certain of, though, is that it simply isn't possible to broadcast any sort of signal from this house without Swain's snoops detecting it immediately.
Could there be more of you? I mean, another one in the same unit?
Interesting idea, but no, barring some harrowing secret breakthrough in technology. I'm pushing the current envelope a bit as it is, considering the size of my hardware. I know that from my store of general background information. She looked down at the unit in her hand.
Lanier, she said. Tell me.
10:25:16 a.m., he said. Her head filled with disembodied voices. Petal. If you'll follow me, please, sir. Swain. Come into the billiard room. Third voice. You'd better have a reason for this, Swain. There are three net men waiting in the car. Security will have your address in their database until hell freezes over. Petal. Lovely car, that is, sir. The Daimler. Take your coat. Third voice. What is it, Swain? Why couldn't we meet at Brown's? Swain. Take your coat off, Robin. She's gone. Third voice.
Gone?
Swain, to the sprawl, early this morning. Third voice.
But it isn't time.
Swain, you think I sent her there? The man's reply was hollow, indistinct, lost behind a closing door.
That was Lanier?
Kumiko asked silently. Yes, Colin replied. Petal mentioned him by name in an earlier conversation. Swain and Lanier spent 25 minutes together. Sound of a latch. Movement. Swain. Bloody cock-up. Not mine. I warned you about her. Told you to warn them. Born killer. Probably psychopathic. Lanier.
and your problem, not mine. You need their product and my cooperation.
Swain. And what's your problem, Lanier? Why are you in this? Just to get Mitchell out of the way?
Lanier. Where's my coat?
Swain. Tettle, Mr. Lanier's bloody coat.
Tettle.
Sir?
Lanier. I have the impression they want your razor girl as badly as they want Angie. She's definitely part of the payoff. They'll be taking her, too.
Swain.
Good luck to them, then. She's already in position, in the sprawl. Spoke with her on the phone an hour ago. I'll be putting her together with my man over there, the one who's been arranging for the girl. And you'll be going back over yourself?
Lanier.
This evening.
Swain. Well, then, not to worry.
Lanier. Goodbye, Swain.
Tettle. He's a right bastard, that one.
Swain. I don't like this, really.
Tettle. You like the goods, though, don't you?
Swain.
Can't complain there. But why do you think they want Sally as well?
Tettle. Christ knows. They're welcome to her.
Swain.
They.
I don't like theys.
Tettle.
They mightn't be terribly happy to know she'd gone there on her own stick, with Yanaka's daughter.
Swain.
No. But we have Miss Yanaka back again. Tomorrow I'll tell Sally that Pryor's in Baltimore, getting the girl into shape.
Tettle.
That's an ugly business, that is.
Swain.
Bring a pot of coffee to the study. She lay on her back, eyes closed, Collins' recordings unspooling in her head, direct input to the auditory nerves. Swain seemed to conduct the better part of his dealings in the billiard room, which meant that she heard people arriving and departing, heads and tails of conversations. Two men, one of whom might have been the red-faced man, held an interminable discussion of dog racing and tomorrow's odds. She listened with special interest as Swain and the man from Special Branch, S.B., Swain called it, settled an article of business directly beneath the marble bust, as the man was preparing to leave. She interrupted this segment half a dozen times to request clarification. Colin made educated guesses.
"This is a very corrupt country," she said at last, deeply shocked.
"Perhaps no more than your own," he said.
"But what is Swain paying these people with?"
"Information. I would say that our Mr. Swain has recently come into possession of a very high-grade source of intelligence, and is busy converting it into power. On the basis of what we've heard, I'd hazard that this has probably been his line of work for some time. What's apparent, though, is that he's moving up, getting bigger. There's internal evidence that he's currently a much more important man than he was a week ago. Also, we have the fact of the expanded staff."
"I must tell my friend."
"Shears? Tell her what?"
"What Lanier said, that she would be taken, along with Angela Mitchell."
"Where is she, then?"
"The sprawl, a hotel."
"Phone her, but not from here. Do you have money?"
"A Mitsu Bank chip."
"No good in our phones, sorry. Have any coin?" She got up from the bed and sorted carefully through the odd bits of English money that had accumulated at the bottom of her purse.
"Here," she said,
coming up with a thick gilt coin.
"£10.
Need two of those to make a local call." She tossed the brassy tenner back into her purse.
"No, Colin, not the phone. I know a better way. I want to leave here. Now. Today. Will you help me?"
"Certainly," he said, "though I advise you not to."
"But I will."
"Very well. How do you propose to go about it?"
"I'll tell them," she said, "that I need to go shopping."
27. Bad Lady. The woman must have gotten in sometime after midnight, she figured later, because it was after Pryor came back with the crabs, the second bag of crabs. They really did have some good crabs in Baltimore, and coming off a run always gave her an appetite, so she'd talked him into going back for some more. Gerald kept coming in to change the derms on her arms. She'd give him her best goofy smile every time, squished the trank out of them when he'd gone, and then stick them back on. Finally, Gerald said she should get some sleep. He put out the lights and turned down the fake window to its lowest setting, a blood-red sunset. When she was alone again, she slid her hand between the bed and the wall, found the shock rod in its hole in the foam. She fell asleep without meaning to, the red glow of the window like a sunset in Miami, and she must have dreamed of Eddie, or anyway of Hooky Greens, dancing with somebody up there on the 33rd floor, because when the crash woke her, she wasn't sure where she was, but she had this very clear map of the way out of Hooky Greens, like she knew she'd better take the stairs because there must be some kind of trouble. She was half out of bed when Pryor came through the door, like really through it, because it was still shut when he hit it. He came through it backward, and it just went to splinters and honeycombed chunks of cardboard. She saw him hit the wall, and then the floor, and then he wasn't moving anymore, and someone else was there in the doorway, backlit from the other room, and all she could see of the face were these two curves of reflected red light from that fake sunset. Pulled her legs back into bed and sank back against the wall, her hand sliding down to, "Don't move, bitch!" There was something real scary about that voice, because it was too fucking cheerful, like throwing Pryor through that door had been kind of a treat. I mean, really, don't move. And the woman was across the room in three strides, very close, so close that Mona felt the cold coming off the leather of the woman's jacket. "Okay," Mona said, "okay." Then hands grabbed her, fast, and she was flat on her back, shoulders pressed down hard into the foam, and something, the shock rod, was right in front of her face. "Where'd you get this little thing?" "Oh," Mona said, like it was something she might have seen once but forgotten about. "It was in my boyfriend's jacket. I borrowed his jacket." Mona's heart was pounding. There was something about those glasses. "Did Shithead know you had this little thing?"
"Who?"
"Pryor," the woman said, and let go of her, turning. Then she was kicking him, kicking Pryor over and over, hard. "No," she said, stopping as abruptly as she'd begun. "I don't think Pryor knew." Then Gerald was in the doorway, just like nothing had happened, except he was looking ruefully at the part of the door that was still on the frame, rubbing his thumb over an edge of splintered laminate. "Coffee, Molly?"
"Two coffees, Gerald," the woman said, examining the shock rod.
"Mine's black." Mona sipped her coffee and studied the woman's clothes and hair while they waited for Pryor to wake up. At least, that's what they seemed to be doing. Gerald was gone again. She wasn't much like anybody Mona'd seen before. Mona couldn't place her on the style map at all, except she must have had some money. The hair was European. Mona'd seen it like that in a magazine. She was pretty sure it wasn't this season's style anywhere, but it went okay with the glasses, which were insets, planted right in the skin. Mona'd seen a cabbie in Cleveland had those. And she wore this short jacket, very dark brown, too plain for Mona's taste, but obviously new, with a big white sheepskin collar, open now over a weird green thing thrust across her breasts and stomach like armor, which was what Mona figured it probably was, and jeans cut from some kind of gray-green mossy suede, thick and soft, and Mona thought they were the best thing about her outfit. She could have gone for a pair of those herself, except the boots spoiled them, these knee-high black boots, the kind bike racers wore, with thick yellow rubber soles and big straps across the insteps, chrome buckles all up and down, horrible clunky toes. And where'd she get that nail color, that burgundy? Mona didn't think they even made that anymore. "What the hell are you looking at?"
Your boots."
"So?"
"They don't make it with your pants."
"Wore 'em to kick the shit out of Pryor." Pryor moaned on the floor and started trying to throw up. It made Mona feel kind of sick herself, so she said she was going to go to the bathroom. "Don't try to leave." The woman seemed to be watching Pryor over the rim of her white china cup, but with those glasses it was hard to be sure. Somehow she found herself in the bathroom with her purse on her lap. She hurried, getting the hit together, didn't grind it fine enough, so it burned the back of her throat. But like Lynette used to say, you don't always have time for the niceties. And anyway, wasn't that all a lot better now? There was a little shower in Gerald's bathroom, but it looked like it hadn't been used for a long time. She took a closer look and saw gray mold growing around the drain, and spots that looked like dried blood. When she came back, the woman was dragging Pryor into one of the other rooms, pulling him by his feet. He had socks on, no shoes, Mona noticed now, like maybe he'd had his feet up to sleep. His blue shirt had blood on it, and his face was all bruised. What Mona felt, as the rush kicked in, was a bright and innocent curiosity. "What are you doing?" "I think I'll have to wake him up," the woman said, like she was on the subway, talking about another passenger who was about to miss his stop. Mona followed her into the room where Gerald did his work, everything clean and hospital white. She watched as the woman got Pryor up into a sort of chair, like in a salon, with levers and buttons and things. "It isn't like she's that strong," Mona thought. "It's like she knows which way to throw the weight." Pryor's head fell to the side as the woman fastened a black strap across his chest. Mona was starting to feel sorry for him, but then she remembered Eddie. "What is it?" The woman was filling a white plastic container with water from a chrome tap. Mona just kept trying to say it, feeling her heart race out of control on the whiz. "He killed Eddie," she kept trying to say, but it wouldn't come out. But then it must have, because the woman said, "Yeah, he'll do that sort of thing, if you let him." She threw the water over Pryor, into his face and all down his shirt. His eyes snapped open, and the white of the left one was solid red. The metal prongs of the shock rod snapped white sparks when the woman pressed it against the wet blue shirt. Pryor screamed. Gerald had to get down on his hands and knees to pull her out from under the bed. He had cool, very gentle hands. She couldn't remember how she'd gotten under there, but now everything was quiet. Gerald had on a gray topcoat and dark glasses. "You're going with Molly now, Mona," he said. She started to shake. "I think I'd better give you something for your nerves." She jerked back out of his grip.
"No! Don't fucking touch me!"
"Leave it, Gerald," the woman said from the door. "It's time you go now." "I don't think you know what you're doing," he said, "but good luck."
"Thanks."
"Think you'll miss the place?" "No. I was going to retire soon anyway." "So was I," the woman said. And then Gerald left, without even a nod for Mona. "Got any clothes?" the woman asked Mona. "Get them on. We're leaving too." Dressing, Mona found she couldn't button her dress over her new breasts, so she left it open, putting Michael's jacket on and zipping it up to her chin. 28. Company. Sometimes he just needed to stand there and look up at the judge, or squat on the concrete beside the witch. It held back the memory stutter to do that. Not the fugues, the real flashbacks, but this jerky, unfocused feeling he got, like the memory tape kept slipping in his head, losing minute increments of experience. So he was doing that now, and it was working. And finally he noticed Cherry was there beside him. Gentry was up in the loft with the shape he'd captured, what he called a macroform node, and he'd hardly listened to what Slick had tried to tell him about the house and that whole place and Bobby the Count. So Slick had come down here to crouch next to an investigator in the cold and dark, retracing all the things he'd done with so many different tools, and where he'd scrounged each part. And then Cherry reached out and touched his cheek with her cold hand. "You okay?" she asked. "I thought maybe it was happening to you again." "No. It's just I gotta come down here sometimes." "He plugged you into the Count's box, didn't he?" "Bobby," Slick said. "That's his name. I saw him."
"Where?"
"In there. It's a whole world. There's this house, like a castle or something, and he's there."
"By himself?"
He said Angie Mitchell's in there, too. Maybe he's crazy.
Is she?
I didn't see her. Saw a car he said was hers. She's in some celebrity detox place in Jamaica, last I heard. He shrugged. I don't know. What's he like? He looked younger. Anybody'd look bad with all those tubes and shit in him. He figured Kid Africa dumped him here because he got scared. He said if anybody comes looking for him, we'd jack him into the Matrix. Why? Don't know. You should have asked him. He shrugged again. Seen Bird anywhere?
No.
Should have been back already. He stood up. Little Bird came back at dusk on Gentry's bike, the dark wings of his hair damp with snow and flapping behind him as he roared in across the solitude. Slick winced. Little Bird was in the wrong gear. Little Bird jolted up an incline of compacted oil drums and hit the brakes when he should have gunned it. Cherry gasped as Bird and the bike separated in midair. The bike seemed to hang there for a second before it somersaulted into the rusted sheet metal tangle that had been one of factory's outbuildings, and Little Bird was rolling over and over on the ground. Somehow Slick never heard the crash. He was standing beside Cherry in the shelter of a doorless loading bay. Then he was sprinting across snow-flecked rust to the fallen rider, no transition. Little Bird lay on his back with blood on his lips, his mouth partially hidden by the jumble of thongs and amulets he wore around his neck.
"Don't touch him," Cherry said. "Ribs may be broken, or he's mashed up inside."
Little Bird's eyes opened at the sound of her voice. He pursed his lips and spat blood and part of a tooth.
"Don't move," Cherry said, kneeling beside him and switching to the crisp diction she'd learned in medtech school. "You may have been injured." "Fuck it, lady," he managed, and struggled stiffly up with Slick's help. "All right, asshole," she said. "Hemorrhage. See if I give a shit."
"Didn't get it," Little Bird said, smearing blood across his face with the back of his hand.
"The truck."
"I can see that," Slick said.
"Marvy and them, they got company. Like flies on shit. Couple of hovers and a copter and shit. All these guys."
"What kind of guys?"
"Like soldiers, but they're not. Soldier'll goof around, bullshit, crack jokes when nobody important's looking. But not them."
"Cops?"
Marvy and his two brothers grew mutant ruderalis in a dozen half-buried railway tank cars. Sometimes they tried to cook primitive amine compounds, but their lab kept blowing up. They were the nearest thing factory had to permanent neighbors. 6 kilometers.
"Cops?"
Little Bird spat another tooth chip and gingerly probed his mouth with a bloody finger.
"They aren't doing anything against the law. Anyway, cops can't afford shit like that. New hovers, new Honda."
He grinned through a film of blood and spittle.
"I hung off in the solitude and scoped 'em good. Nobody I'd want to talk to, or you either. Guess I really fucked Gentry's bike, huh?"
"Don't worry about it," Slick said. "I think his mind's on something else."
"That's good."
He staggered in the direction of factory, nearly fell, caught himself, continued.
"He's hiring a kite," Cherry said.
"Hey, Bird," Slick called. "What happened to that bag of shit I gave you to give Marvy?"
Bird swayed, turned.
"Lost it."
Then he was gone, around a corner of corrugated steel.
"Maybe he's making that up," Cherry said. "About those guys, or seeing things."
"I doubt it," Slick said, pulling her into deeper shadow as an unlit black Honda swung down toward factory out of winter twilight. He heard the Honda making its fifth pass over factory as he pounded up the quaking stairs, the iron roof rattling with the copter's passage. Well, he thought, that should anyway bring it to Gentry's attention that they had visitors. He took the fragile catwalk in 10 long, slow steps. He was beginning to wonder if they'd ever be able to get the count and his stretcher back out without having to weld an extra eye bar across the span. He went into the bright loft without knocking. Gentry was sitting at a workbench, his head cocked to one side, staring up at the plastic skylight. The bench was littered with bits of hardware and small tools.
Helicopter, Slick said, panting from the climb.
Helicopter, Gentry agreed, nodding thoughtfully, his disheveled rooster tail bobbing.
They seem to be looking for something.
I think they just found it.
Could be the fishing authority.
Bird saw people at Marvie's. Saw that copter there, too. You weren't paying much attention when I tried to tell you what he said.
Bird? Gentry looked down at the small, bright things on the workbench.
Picked up two fittings and twisted them together. The Count. He told me...
Bobby Newmark, Gentry said.
Yes.
I know a lot more about Bobby Newmark now.
Cherry came in behind Slick.
You gotta do something about that bridge, she said, going immediately to the stretcher. It shakes too much.
She bent to check the Count's readout. Come here, Slick, Gentry said, standing. He walked to the hollow table. Slick followed, looked at the image that glowed there. It reminded him of the rugs he'd seen in the gray house, patterns like that, only these were woven of hair-fine neon and twisted into some kind of infinite knot. The knot's core hurt his head to look at it. He looked away.
That's it? He asked Gentry.
What you've always been looking for?
No, I told you. This is just a node, a macroform, a model.
He's got this house in there, like a castle, and grass, and trees, and sky.
He's got a lot more than that. He's got a universe more than that. That was just a construct worked up from a commercial stim. What he's got is an abstract of the sum total of data constituting cyberspace. Still, it's closer than I've gotten before. He didn't tell you why he was in there.
Didn't ask him.
Then you'll have to go back.
Hey, Gentry, listen up. That copter, it'll be back. It'll be back with two hovers full of guys Bird said looked like soldiers. They aren't after us, man. They're after him.
Maybe they're his. Maybe they are after us.
No, he told me, man. He said anybody comes looking for him, we're in deep shit, and we gotta jack him into the Matrix.
Gentry looked down at the little coupling he still held. We'll talk with him, Slick. You'll go back. This time I'll go with you. 29. Winter Journey. Petal had agreed, finally, but only after she'd suggested phoning her father for permission. That had sent him shuffling unhappily off in search of Swain, and when he'd returned, looking no happier, the answer had been yes. Bundled in several layers of her warmest clothing, she stood in the white-painted foyer, studying the hunting prints while Petal lectured the red-faced man, whose name was Dick, behind closed doors. She couldn't distinguish individual words, only a low torrent of admonition. The Mas Neotech unit was in her pocket, but she avoided touching it. Twice already, Colin had tried to dissuade her. Now Dick emerged from Petal's lecture with his hard little mouth set in a smile. Under his tight black suit, he wore a pink cashmere turtleneck and a thin gray lamb's wool cardigan. His black hair was plastered tightly back against his skull. His pale cheeks were shadowed by a few hours' growth of beard. She palmed the unit in her pocket.
"Lo," Dick said, looking her up and down.
"Where shall we go for our walk?"
"Portobello Road," Colin said, slouched against the wall beside the crowded coat rack. Dick took a dark overcoat from the rack, reaching through Colin to do it, put it on and buttoned it. He pulled on a bulky pair of black leather gloves.
"Portobello Road," Kumiko said, releasing the unit. "How long have you worked for Mr. Swain?" she asked, as they made their way along the icy pavement of the crescent.
"Long enough," he replied. "Mind you don't slip. Wicked heels on those boots."
Kumiko tottered along beside him on black French patent spikes. As she'd predicted, it was virtually impossible to navigate the glass-hard rippled patches of ice in these boots. She took his hand for support. Doing this, she felt solid metal across his palm. The gloves were weighted, the fingers reinforced with carbon mesh.
He was silent as they turned the side street at the end of the crescent, but when they reached Portobello Road, he paused. "Excuse me, miss," he said, a note of hesitation in his voice, "but is it true what the boys say?"
"Boys? Excuse me?"
"Swain's boys, his regulars. That you're the big fellow's daughter, the big fellow back in Tokyo."
"I'm sorry," she said. "I don't understand."
"Yanaka. Your name's Yanaka?"
"Kumiko Yanaka, yes."
He peered at her with intense curiosity. Then worry crossed his face, and he glanced carefully around. "Lord," he said, "must be true." His squat, tightly buttoned body was taut and alert. "Governor said you wanted to shop?"
"Yes, thank you."
"Where shall I take you?"
"Here," she said,
and led him into a narrow arcade lined solidly with British gomi. Her Shinjuku shopping expeditions served her well with Dick. The techniques she'd devised for torturing her father's secretaries proved just as effective now, as she forced the man to participate in dozens of pointless choices between one Edwardian medallion and another, this or that fragment of stained glass, though she was careful only to choose items, finally, that were fragile and very heavy, awkward to carry, and extremely expensive. A cheerful bilingual shop assistant accessed an 80,000-pound charge against Kumiko's Mitsubank chip. Kumiko slipped her hand into the pocket that held the mass Neotech unit. "Exquisite," the English girl said in Japanese, as she wrapped Kumiko's purchase, an ormolu vase encrusted with griffins. "Hideous," Colin commented in Japanese. "An imitation as well." He reclined on a Victorian horsehair sofa, his boots up on an Art Deco cocktail stand supported by Airstream aluminum angels. The shop assistant added the wrapped vase to Dick's burden. This was Dick's 11th antique shop and Kumiko's 8th purchase. "I think you'd better make your move," Colin advised. "Any moment now, our Dick will buzz Swain's for a car to take that lot home." "Think this is it, then?" Dick asked hopefully over Kumiko's purchases.
"One more shop, please."
Kumiko smiled. "Right," he said grimly. As he was following her out the door, she drove the heel of her left boot into a gap in the pavement she'd noticed on her way in. "You all right?" he asked, seeing her stumble.
"I've broken the heel of my boot."
She hobbled back into the shop and sat down beside Colin on the horsehair sofa. The assistant came fussing up to help. "Get him off quick," Colin advised, "before Dickie puts his parcels down." She unzipped the boot with the broken heel, then the other, pulled off both. In place of the coarse Chinese silk she usually wore in winter, her feet were sheathed in thin black rubber toe socks with ridged plastic soles. She nearly ran between Dick's legs as she cleared the door, but instead her shoulder struck his thigh as she squeezed past, toppling him into a display of faceted crystal decanters. And then she was free, plunging through the press of tourists down Portobello Road. Her feet were very cold, but the ridged plastic sole provided excellent traction. Though not on ice, she reminded herself, picking herself up from her second spill, wet grit against her palms. Colin had directed her down this narrow passage of blackened brick. She grasped the unit.
"Where next?"
"This way," he said.
"I want the Rose and Crown," she reminded him.
"You want to be careful. Dickie'll have Swain's men here by now, not to mention the sort of hunt that friend of Swain's from Special Branch could mount if he's asked to, and I can't imagine why he shouldn't be asked to." She entered the Rose and Crown by a side door, Colin at her elbow, grateful for the snug gloom and irradiating warmth that seemed central to the idea of these drinking burrows. She was struck by the amount of padding on the walls and seats, by the muffling curtains. If the colors and fabrics had been less dingy, the effect would somehow have been less warm. Pubs, she guessed, were an extreme expression of the British attitude toward gomi. At Colin's urging, she made her way through the drinkers clustered in front of the bar, hoping to find Tick.
"What'll it be, dear?"
She looked up into the broad blonde face behind the bar, bright lipstick and rouged cheeks.
Excuse me, Kumiko began. I wish to speak with Mr. Bevan.
Mine's a pint, Alice, someone said, slapping down 3 10-pound coins. Lager. Alice worked a tall white ceramic lever, filling a mug with pale beer. She put the mug on the scarred bar and swept the money into a rattling till behind the counter. Someone wanting a word, Bevan, Alice said as the man lifted his pint. Kumiko looked up at a flushed, seamed face. The man's upper lip was short. Kumiko thought of rabbits, though Bevan was large, nearly as large as Petal. He had a rabbit's eyes as well, round, brown, showing very little white. With me? His accent reminded her of Tick's. Tell him, yes, Colin said. He can't think why a little Jap girl in rubber socks has come into the drinker looking for him.
I wish to find Tick.
Devon regarded her neutrally over the rim of his raised pint. Sorry, he said. Can't say I know anyone by the name.
He drank. Sally told me I should find you if Tick wasn't here. Sally Shears.
Bevan choked on his lager, his eyes showing a fraction of white. Coughing, he set the mug on the bar and took a handkerchief from his overcoat pocket. He blew his nose and wiped his mouth. I'm on duty in 5, he said. Best step in the back. Alice raised a hinged section of the bar. Bevan ushered Kumiko through with small flapping motions of his large hands, glancing quickly over his shoulder. He guided her down a narrow passage that opened off the area behind the bar. The walls were brick, old and uneven, thickly coated with dirty green paint. He stopped beside a battered steel hamper heaped with terry bar towels that reeked of beer. You'll regret it if you're on a con, girl, he said. Tell me why you're looking for this Tick.
Sally is in danger. I must find Tick. I must tell him.
Fucking hell, the barman said. Put yourself in my position. Colin wrinkled his nose at the hamper of sodden towels.
Yes? Kumiko said.
If you're a narc, and I sent you to find this Tick fellow, assuming I did know him, and he's on some sort of blag, then he'd do for me, wouldn't he? But if you're not, then this Sally, she'd likely do for me if I don't, understand?
Kumiko nodded. Between the rock and the hard place.
It was an idiom Sally had used. Kumiko found it very poetic. Quite, Bevan said, giving her an odd look.
Help me. She is in very great danger.
He ran his palm back across thinning ginger-colored hair.
You will help me, she heard herself say, feeling her mother's cold mask click into place. Tell me where to find Tick.
The barman seemed to shiver, though it was overly warm in the passageway, a steamy warmth, beer smell mingling with raw notes of disinfectant. Do you know London?
Colin winked at her. I can find my way, she said.
Bevan, Alice said, putting her head around the corner. The filth.
Police, Colin translated.
Margate Road, SW2, Bevan said. Don't know the number, don't know the phone.
Let him show you out the back now, Colin said. Those are no ordinary policemen.
Kumiko would always remember her endless ride through the city's underground. How Colin led her from the Rose and Crown to Holland Park and down, explaining that her Mitsubank chip was worse than useless now. If she used it for a cab, or any sort of purchase, he said, some special branch operator would see the transaction flare like magnesium on the grid of cyberspace. But she had to find Tick, she told him. She had to find Margate Road. He frowned. No, he said, wait till dark. Brixton wasn't far, but the streets were too dangerous now, by daylight, with the police on Swain's side.
But where could she hide, she asked. She had very little cash. The concept of currency, of coins and paper notes, was quaint and alien.
Here, he said, as she rode a lift down into Holland Park, for the price of a ticket. The bulgy silver shapes of the trains, the soft old seats in gray and green, and warm, beautifully warm,
Another burrow, here in the realm of ceaseless movement. 30. The Rip. The airport sucked a groggy Danielle Stark away down a pastel corridor lined with reporters, cameras, augmented eyes, while Porphyry and three knit security men swept Angie through the closing ring of journalists, a choreographed piece of ritual that had more to do with providing dramatic visuals than protection. Anyone present had already been cleared by security and the PR department. Then she was alone with Porphyry in an express elevator on their way to the heliport the net maintained on the terminal's roof. As the doors opened into gusts of wet wind across brilliantly lit concrete, where a new trio of security men waited in giant fluorescent orange parkas, Angie remembered her first glimpse of the sprawl when she'd ridden the train up from Washington with Turner. One of the orange parkas ushered them across an expanse of spotless concrete to the waiting helicopter, a large twin-prop Fokker finished in black chrome. Porphyry led the way up the spidery matte-black stairway. She followed without looking back. She had something now, a new determination. She'd decided to contact Hans Becker through his agent in Paris. Continuity had the number. It was time. Time to make something happen. And she'd make something happen with Robin as well. He'd be waiting now, she knew, at the hotel. The helicopter told them to fasten their seatbelts. As they lifted off, there was virtual silence in the soundproof cabin, only a throbbing in the bones, and for a strange second she seemed able to hold the whole of her life in mind and know it, see it for what it had been. And it was this, she thought, that the dust had drifted over and concealed, and that had been freedom from pain. "And the sight of the soul's departure," said an iron voice out of candle glow and the roar of the hive. "Missy?" Porphyry, from the seat beside her, leaning close. "I'm dreaming." Something had been waiting for her, years ago, in the net. Nothing like the Loa, like Legba or the others. Though Legba, she knew, was Lord of the Crossroads. He was synthesis, the cardinal point of magic, communication. "Porphyry," she asked, "why did Bobby leave?" She looked out at the sprawl's tangled grid of light, at the domes picked out in red beacons, seeing instead the datascape that had drawn him, always, back to what he'd believed was the only game worth playing. "If you don't know, Missy," Porphyry said, "who does?" "But you hear things. Everything. All the rumors. You always have." "Why ask me now?" "It's time." "I remember talk, understand? How people who aren't famous talk about those who are. Maybe someone who claimed they knew Bobby talked to someone else and it came around. Bobby was worth talking about because he was with you, understand? That's a good place to start, Missy. Because he wouldn't have found that so very gratifying, would he? Story was, he'd set out hustling on his own, but he'd found you instead, and you rolled higher and faster than anything he could have dreamed of. Took him up there, understand? Where the kind of money he'd never even dreamed of back in Berrytown was just change." Angie nodded, looking out over the sprawl. "Talk was, he had his own ambitions, Missy. Something driving him. Drove him off, finally." "I didn't think he'd leave me," she said. "When I first came to the sprawl, it was like being born. A new life. And he was there, right there, the very first night. Later, when Legba... when I was with the net..."
"When you were becoming Angie."
"Yes. And as much of me as that took... I knew he'd be there, and also that he'd never buy it entirely, and I needed that, how it was still just a scam to him, the whole business."
"The net?"
"Angie Mitchell. He knew the difference between it and me."
"Did he?"
"Maybe he was the difference."
So high above the lines of light.
The old New Suzuki Envoy had been Angie's favorite sprawl hotel since her earliest days with the net. It maintained its street wall for 11 stories, then narrowed jaggedly at the first of 9 setbacks into a mountainside assembled from bedrock excavated from its Madison Square building site. Original plans had called for this steep landscape to be planted with flora native to the Hudson Valley region and populated with suitable fauna, but subsequent construction of the first Manhattan Dome had made it necessary to hire a Paris-based eco-design team. The French ecologists, accustomed to the pure design problems posed by orbital systems, had despaired of the sprawl's particulate-laden atmosphere, opting for heavily engineered strains of vegetation and robotic fauna of the sort encountered in children's theme parks. But Angie's continued patronage had eventually lent the place a cachet it would otherwise have lacked. The net leased the 5 topmost floors, where her permanent suite had been installed, and the Envoy had come to enjoy a certain belated reputation with artists and entertainers. Now she smiled as the helicopter rose past a disinterested robot bighorn pretending to munch lichen beside the illuminated waterfall. The absurdity of the place always delighted her. Even Bobby had enjoyed it. She glanced out at the Envoy's heliport, where the SenseNet logo had been freshly repainted on heated, floodlit concrete. A lone figure, hooded in a bright orange parka, waited beside a sculpted outcropping of rock. "Robin will be here, won't he, Porphyry?" "Mr. Lanier," he said sourly. She sighed. The black chrome Fokker brought them smoothly down, glasses tinkling gently in the drinks cabinet as the landing gear met the roof of the Envoy. The muted throb of the engines died. "Where Robin is concerned, Porphyry, I'll have to make the first move. I'm going to speak with him tonight, alone. In the meantime, I want you to stay out of his way." "Porphyry's pleasure, Missy," the hairdresser said as the cabin door opened behind them. And then he was twisting, clawing at the buckle of his seatbelt, and Angie turned in time to see the bright orange parka in the hatchway, the upraised arm, the mirrored glasses. The gun made no more sound than a cigarette lighter, but Porphyry convulsed, one long black hand slapping at his throat as the security man swung the hatch shut behind him and sprang at Angie. Something was clapped hard against her stomach as Porphyry lolled back bonelessly in his seat, the sharp pink tip of his tongue protruding. She looked down in pure reflex and saw the black chrome buckle of her seatbelt through a sticky-looking lozenge of greenish plastic. She looked up into a white oval face framed by a tightly drawn orange nylon hood, saw her own face blank with shock, doubled in the silver lenses. "He drink tonight?"
"What?"
"Him." A thumb jerked in Porphyry's direction. "He drink any alcohol?"
"Yes. Earlier."
"Shit." A woman's voice as she turned to the unconscious hairdresser. "Now I've sedated him. Don't want to suppress his breathing reflex, you know." Angie watched as the woman checked Porphyry's pulse. "Guess he's okay." Did she shrug inside the orange parka?
"Security?"
"What?" The glasses flashed.
"Are you net security?"
"Fuck no, I'm abducting you."
"You are?"
"You bet."
"Why?"
"Not for any of the usual reasons. Somebody's got it in for you. Got it in for me, too. I was supposed to set it up to grab you next week. Fuck 'em. Had to talk to you anyway."
"You did? Talk to me?"
"Know anybody name of 3 Jane?"
"No. I mean, yes, but..."
"Save it. Our ass is out of here, fast."
"Porphyry.
He's gonna wake up soon. Look of him, I don't want to be around when he does." 31. 3 Jane. If this was part of Bobby's big gray house in the country, Slick decided, opening his eyes on the cramped curve of the narrow corridor, then it was a stranger place than it had seemed the first time. The air was thick and dead, and the light from the greenish glass tile ceiling strip made him feel like he was underwater. The tunnel was made of some kind of glazed concrete. It felt like jail. "Maybe we came out in the basement or something," he said. noticing the faint ping of echo off the concrete when he spoke. No reason we'd cut into the construct you saw before, Gentry said.
So what is it?
Slick touched the concrete wall. It was warm. Doesn't matter, Gentry said. Gentry started walking in the direction they were both facing. Past the curve, the floor became an uneven mosaic of shattered china, fragments pressed into something like epoxy, slippery under their boots.
Look at this stuff.
Thousands of different patterns and colors in the broken bits, but no overall design in how it had been put down. Just random.
Art.
Gentry shrugged. Somebody's hobby. You should appreciate that, Slick Henry. Whoever it was, they hadn't bothered with the walls. Slick knelt to run his fingers over it, feeling raw edges of broken ceramic, glassy, hardened plastic in between.
What's that supposed to mean? Hobby?
It's like those things you build, Slick. Your junk toys. Gentry grinned his tense, crazy grin.
You don't know, Slick said. Spend your whole fucking life trying to figure out what cyberspace is shaped like, man. And it probably isn't even shaped like anything. And anyway, who gives a shit?
There wasn't anything random about the judge and the others. The process was random, but the results had to conform to something inside, something he couldn't touch directly.
Come on, Gentry said.
Slick stayed where he was, looking up at Gentry's pale eyes, gray in this light, his taut face.
Why did he put up with Gentry, anyway?
Because you needed somebody in the solitude. Not just for electricity. That whole landlord routine was really just a shuck. He guessed because you needed somebody around. Bird wasn't any good to talk to because there wasn't much he was interested in, and all he talked was Stringtown stupid. And even if Gentry never admitted it, Slick felt like Gentry understood about some things.
Yeah, Slick said, getting up. Let's go.
The tunnel wound in on itself like a gut. The section with the mosaic floor was back there now, around however many curves and up and down short curving stairwells. Slick kept trying to imagine a building that would have insides like this, but he couldn't. Gentry was walking fast, eyes narrowed, chewing on his lip. Slick thought the air was getting worse. Up another stairwell, they hit a straight stretch that narrowed to nothing in the distance, either way you looked. It was broader than the curved parts, and the floor was soft and humpy with little rugs. It looked like hundreds of them, rolled out layers deep over the concrete. Each rug had its own pattern and colors, lots of reds and blues, but all the patterns were the same zaggy diamonds and triangles. The dusty smell was thicker here, and Slick figured it had to be the rugs. They looked so old. The ones on top, nearest the center, were worn down to the weave in patches. A trail, like somebody'd been walking up and down there for years. Sections of the overhead light strip were dark, and others pulsed weakly.
"Which way?" he asked Gentry.
Gentry was looking down, working his thick lower lip between finger and thumb.
"This way."
"How come?"
"Because it doesn't matter."
It made Slick's legs tired walking over those rugs. Had to watch not to snag his toes in the ones with holes worn through. Once he stepped over a glass tile that had fallen from the light strip. At regular intervals now, they were passing sections of wall that looked as though portals had been sealed over with more concrete. There wasn't anything there, just the same arched shape in slightly paler concrete, with a slightly different texture.
Gentry, this has got to be underground, right? Like a basement under something.
But Gentry just brought his arm up, so that Slick bumped into it, and they both were standing there, staring at the girl at the end of the corridor, not a dozen meters across the waves of carpet. She said something in a language Slick guessed was French. The voice was light and musical, the tone matter-of-fact. She smiled. Pale under a twist of dark hair, a fine, high-boned face, strong, thin nose, and wide mouth. Slick felt Gentry's arm trembling against his chest.
"It's okay," he said, taking Gentry's arm and lowering it.
"We're just looking for Bobby."
"Everyone's looking for Bobby," she said,
English with an accent he didn't know.
I'm looking for him myself, for his body. Have you seen his body?
She took a step back, away from them, like she was about to run.
We won't hurt you,
Slick said, suddenly aware of his own smell, of the grease worked into his jeans and brown jacket. And Gentry didn't really look all that much more reassuring.
I shouldn't think so, she said,
and her white teeth flashed again in the stale undersea light.
But then, I don't think I fancy either of you.
Slick wanted Gentry to say something, but Gentry didn't. You know him, Bobby? Slick ventured.
He's really a very clever man. Extraordinarily clever. Although, I don't think I fancy him, really.
She wore something loose and black that hung to her knees. Her feet were bare.
Nonetheless, I want his body.
She laughed. Everything changed. Juice? Bobby the Count asked, holding out a tall glass of something yellow. The water in the turquoise pool reflected shifting blobs of sunlight on the palm fronds above his head. He was naked, aside from a pair of very dark glasses. What's the matter with your friend? Nothing, Slick heard Gentry say. He did time on induced Korsakoff's. Transition like that scares the shit out of him. Slick lay very still on the white iron lounge chair with the blue cushions, feeling the sun bake through his greasy jeans. You're the one he mentioned, right? Bobby asked. Name's Gentle? Own a factory? Gentry. You're a cowboy. Bobby smiled. Console jockey. Cyberspace man. No. Bobby rubbed his chin. You know I have to shave in here? Cut myself. There's a scar. He drank half the glass of juice and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. You're not a jockey. How else you get in here? Gentry unzipped his beaded jacket, exposing his bone-white hairless chest. Do something about the sun, he said. Twilight, like that. Not even a click. Slick heard himself groan. Insects began to creak in the palms beyond the whitewashed wall. Sweat cooled on his ribs. Sorry, man, Bobby said to Slick. That Korsakoff's, that must be some sad shit. But this place is beautiful. Vallarta. Belonged to Tally Isham. He turned his attention to Gentry again. If you're not a cowboy, fella, what are you? I'm like you, Gentry said. I'm a cowboy. A lizard scooted diagonally up the wall behind Bobby's head. No, you aren't here to steal anything, Newmark. How do you know? You're here to learn something. Same thing? No. You were a cowboy once, but now you're something else. You're looking for something, but there's nobody to steal it from. I'm looking for it, too. And Gentry began to explain about the shape, as the palm shadows gathered and thickened into Mexican night, and Bobby the Count sat and listened. When Gentry was done, Bobby sat there for a long time without saying anything. Then he said, Yeah, you're right. How I think of it, I'm trying to find out what brought the change. Before that, Gentry said, it didn't have a shape. Hey, Slick said, before we were here, we were somewhere else. Where was that? Straylight, Bobby said. Up the well. In orbit. Who's that girl? Girl? Dark hair, skinny. Oh, Bobby said in the dark. That was 3 Jane. You saw her? Weird girl, Slick said. Dead girl, Bobby said. You saw her construct. Blew her family fortune to build this thing. You hang out with her? In here? She hates my guts. See, I stole it. Stole her soul catcher.
She had her construct in place in here when I took off for Mexico, so she's always been around. Thing was, she died. Outside, I mean. Meantime, all her shit outside, all her scams and schemes, that's being run by lawyers, programs, more flunkies. He grinned. It really pisses her off. The people who are trying to get into your place to get the Aleph back, they work for somebody else who works for some people she hired out on the coast. But yeah, I've done the odd deal with her. Traded things. She's crazy, but she plays a tight game. Not even a click. At first he thought he was back in the gray house, where he'd seen Bobby the first time, but this room was smaller and the carpets and furniture were different. He couldn't say how. Rich, but not as glittery. Quiet. A lamp with a green glass shade glowed on a long wooden table. Tall windows with frames painted white, dividing the white beyond that into rectangles, each pane. And that must be snow. He stood with his cheek touching soft drapes, looking out into a walled space of snow. "London," Bobby said. "She had to trade me this to get the serious voodoo shit. Thought they wouldn't have anything to do with her. Fuck of a lot of good it did her. They've been fading, sort of blurring. You can still raise them sometimes, but their personalities run together." "That fits," Gentry said. "They came out of the first cause, when it changed. You already figured that. But you don't know what happened yet, do you?"
"No.
I just know where. Straylight. She's told me all that part. I think all she knows. Doesn't really care about it. Her mother put together a couple of AIs very early on, real heavy stuff. Then her mother died, and the AIs sort of stewed in the corporate cores up there. One of them started doing deals on its own. It wanted to get together with the other one." "It did. There's your first cause. Everything changed."
"Simple as that? How do you know?"
"Because," Gentry said, "I've been at it from another angle. You've been playing cause and effect, but I've been looking for outlines, shapes in time. You've been looking all over the Matrix, but I've been looking at the Matrix. The whole thing. I know things you don't." Bobby didn't answer. Slick turned from the window and saw the girl, the same one, standing across the room. Just standing there. "It wasn't just the Tessier Ashpool AIs," Gentry said. "People came up the well to crack the TA cores. They brought a Chinese military icebreaker." "Case," Bobby said. "Guy named Case. I know that part. Some kind of synergistic effect." Slick watched the girl. "And the sum was greater than the parts?" Gentry really seemed to be enjoying this. "Cybernetic godhead? Light on the waters?"
"Yeah," Bobby said. "That's about it."
"It's a little more complicated than that," Gentry said and laughed. And the girl was gone. No click. Slick shivered. 32. Winter Journey. 2. Night fell during the underground's peak evening traffic, though even then it was nothing like Tokyo. No Shiroshi-san, struggling to wedge a last few passengers in as the doors were closing. Kumiko watched the salmon haze of sunset from a windy platform on the central line. Colin lounging against a broken vending machine with a row of cracked, dusty windows. "Time now," he said, "and keep your head demurely down through Bond Street and Oxford Circus."
"But I must pay when I leave the system?"
"Not everyone does, actually," he said, tossing his forelock. She set off for the stairs, no longer requiring his directions to find her way to the opposite platform. Her feet were very cold again, and she thought of the fleece-lined German boots in the closet in her room at Swain's. She'd decided on the combination of the rubber toe socks and the high French heels as a ploy to lull Dick, to make him doubt she'd run, but with each bite of cold through the thin soles, she regretted the idea. In the tunnel to the other platform, she relaxed her grip on the unit, and Colin flickered out. The walls were worn white ceramic with a decorative band of green.
She took her hand from her pocket and trailed her fingers along the green tiles as she went, thinking of Sally and the Finn and the different smell of a Sprawl winter, until the first Dracula stepped smartly in front of her and she was instantly and very closely surrounded by four black raincoats, four bone-thin, bone-white faces. "Here," the first one said, "in it pretty." They were eye to eye, Kumiko and the Dracula. His breath smelled of tobacco. The evening crowd continued on its way around them, bundled for the most part in dark wool.
"Ooh," one said beside her. "Look, what's this?"
He held up the Mass Neotech unit, his hand gloved in cracked black leather.
"Flashlighter, innit? Let's have a snag, Jap."
Kumiko's hand went to her pocket, shot straight through the razor slash, and closed on air. The boy giggled.
"Snag's in her bag," another said. "Help her, Reg."
A hand darted out, and the leather strap of her purse parted neatly. The first Dracula caught the purse, whipped the dangling strap around it with a practiced flick, and tucked it into the front of his raincoat.
"Taw! Here, she's got 'em in her pants!"
Laughter as she fumbled beneath layered sweaters. The tape she'd used hurt her stomach as she tore the gun free with both hands and flipped it up against the cheek of the boy who held the unit. Nothing happened. Then the other three were racing frantically for the stairs at the far end of the tunnel, their high-laced black boots slipping in melted snow, their long coats flapping like wings. A woman screamed. And still they were frozen there, Kumiko and the Dracula, the muzzle of the pistol pressed against his left cheekbone. Kumiko's arms began to tremble. She was looking into the Dracula's eyes, brown eyes gone wide with an ancient simple terror. The Dracula was seeing her mother's mask. Something struck the concrete at her feet. Colin's unit.
"Run," she said.
The Dracula convulsed, opened his mouth, made a strangled sobbing sound, and twisted away from the gun. Kumiko looked down and saw the Mass Neotech unit in a puddle of gray slush. Beside it lay the clean silver rectangle of a single-edged industrial razor blade. When she picked up the unit, she saw that its case was cracked. She shook moisture from the crack and squeezed it hard in her hand. The tunnel was deserted now. Colin wasn't there. Swain's Valter air pistol was huge and heavy in her other hand. She stepped to a rectangular receptacle fastened to the tile wall and tucked the gun down between a grease-flecked foam food container and a neatly folded sheaf of newsfax. Turned away, then turned back for the fax. Up the stairs. Someone pointed at her, on the platform, but the train roared in with its antique clatter, and then the doors slid shut behind her. She did as Colin had instructed, White City and Shepherd's Bush, Holland Park, raising the fax as the train slowed for Notting Hill. The king, who was very old, was dying, and keeping it there through Bond Street. The station at Oxford Circus was very busy, and she was grateful for the sheltering crowd. Colin had said that it was possible to leave the station without paying. After some consideration, she decided that this was true, though it required speed and timing. Really, there was no other way. Her purse, with the Mitsu Bank chip and her few English coins, had gone with the Jack Draculas. She spent 10 minutes watching passengers surrender their yellow plastic tickets to the automated turnstiles, took a deep breath, and ran. Up, over, behind her a shout and a loud laugh, and then she was running again. When she reached the doors at the top of the stairs, she saw Brixton Road waiting like a tatty Shinjuku, jammed with steaming food stalls. 33. Star. She was waiting in a car, and she didn't like it. She didn't like waiting anyway, but the whiz she'd done made it really hard. She had to keep reminding herself not to grit her teeth, because whatever Gerald had done to them, they were still sore. She was sore all over, now that she thought about it. Probably the whiz hadn't been such a great idea. The car belonged to the woman, the one Gerald called Molly. Some kind of regular gray Japanese car like a suit would have. Nice enough, but nothing you'd notice. It had that new smell inside, and it was fast when they got out of Baltimore. It had a computer, but the woman drove it herself, all the way back to the Sprawl. And now it was parked on the roof of a 20-level lot that must be close to the hotel where Pryor had taken her,
because she could see that crazy building, the one with the waterfall, fixed up like a mountain. There weren't many other cars up here, and the ones that were humped over with snow, like they hadn't moved in a long time. Except for the two guys in the booth where you drove in, there didn't seem to be anybody around at all. Here she was, in the middle of all those people, the biggest city in the world, and she was alone in the back seat of a car, told to wait. The woman hadn't said much when they'd come from Baltimore, just asked a question now and then, but the whiz had made it hard for Mona not to talk. She'd talked about Cleveland and Florida and Eddie and Pryor. Then they'd driven up here and parked. So this Molly'd been gone at least an hour now, maybe longer. She'd taken a suitcase with her. The only thing Mona'd been able to get out of her was that she'd known Gerald a long time, and Pryor hadn't known that. It was getting cold in the car again, so Mona climbed into the front seat and turned on the heater. She couldn't just leave it on low, because it might run the battery down, and Molly'd said if that happened, they were really in the shit. 'Cause when I come back, we leave in a hurry. Then she'd shown Mona where there was a sleeping bag under the driver's seat. She set the heater on high and held her hands in front of the vent. Then she fiddled with the little vid studs beside the dash monitor and got a news show. The King of England was sick. He was really old. There was a new disease in Singapore. It hadn't killed anybody yet, but nobody knew how you got it or how to cure it. Some people thought there was some kind of big fight going on in Japan, two different bunches of Yakuza guys trying to kill each other, but nobody really knew. Yakuza. That was something Eddie liked to bullshit about. Then these doors popped open, and Angie came through on the arm of this amazing black guy, and the vid voice was saying this was live. She'd just arrived in the sprawl after a brief vacation at her house in Malibu, following treatment at a private drug clinic. Angie looked just great in this big fur, but then the segment was over. Mona remembered what Gerald had done. She touched her face. She shut off the vid, then the heater, and got into the back seat again. Used the corner of the sleeping bag to clean her condensed breath off the window. She looked up at the mountainside building, all lit up, past the sagging chain link at the edge of the car lot's roof. Like a whole country up there. Maybe Colorado or something, like the stim where Angie went to Aspen and met this boy. Only Robin turned up like he almost always did. But what she didn't understand was this clinic stuff, how that barman had said Angie'd gone there because she was wired on something, and now she'd just heard the news guy say it too, so she guessed it had to be true. But why would anybody like Angie, with a life like that and Robin Lanier for a boyfriend, want to do drugs? Mona shook her head, looking out at that building, glad she wasn't hooked on anything. She must have drifted off for a minute, thinking about Lynette, because when she looked again, there was a copter, a big one, glittery black, poised above the mountain building. It looked good, real big town. She'd known some rough women in Cleveland, girls nobody messed with, but this Molly was something else. Remembering Pryor coming through that door, remembering him screaming. She wondered what it was he'd finally admitted, because she'd heard him talking, and Molly hadn't hurt him anymore. They'd left him strapped in that chair, and Mona had asked Molly if she thought he'd get loose. Either that, Molly had said, or somebody finds him, or he dehydrates. The copter settled, vanished. Big one, the kind with the whirly thing at both ends. So here she was, waiting. No fucking idea what else to do. Something Lynette had taught her. Sometimes you had to list your assets. Assets were what you had going for you, and just forget the other stuff. Okay. She was out of Florida. She was in Manhattan. She looked like Angie. That one stopped her. Was that an asset? Okay, putting it another way. She'd just had a fortune in free cosmetic surgery, and she had totally perfect teeth. Anyway, look at it that way, and it wasn't so bad. Think about the flies in the squat. Yeah. If she spent the money she had left on a haircut and some makeup, she could come up with something that didn't look all that much like Angie, which was probably a good idea, because what if somebody was looking for her? There went the copter again, lifting off. Hey. Maybe 2 blocks away and 50 stories higher, the thing's nose swung toward her. Dipped. It's the whiz. Sort of wobbled there, then it was coming down. Whiz. It's not real. Straight down toward her. It just got bigger. Toward her. But it's the whiz, right? Then it was gone, behind another building. And it was just the whiz. It swung around a corner, still 5 stories above the roof of the car lot, and it was still coming down, and it wasn't the whiz, it was on her, a tight white beam stabbing out to find the gray car, and Mona popped the door lock and rolled out into the snow, still in the car's shadow, all around her the thunder of the thing's blades, its engines, Pryor or whoever he worked for, and they were after her. Then the spotlight went out, blades changed pitch, and it came down fast, too fast. Bounced on its landing gear, slammed down again, engines dying, coughing blue flame. Mona was on her hands and knees by the car's rear bumper, slipped when she tried to get to her feet. There was a sound like a gunshot. A square section of the copter's skin blew out and skidded across the lot's salt-stained concrete. A bright orange 5-meter emergency exit slide popped out, inflating like a kid's beach toy. Mona got up more carefully, holding onto the gray car's fender. A dark, bundled figure swung its legs out over the slide and went down, sitting up, just like a kid at a playground. Another figure followed, this one padded in a huge hooded jacket the same color as the slide. Mona shivered as the one in orange led the other toward her across the roof, away from the black copter. It was... But it was...
Want you both in back, Molly said, opening the door on the driver's side.
It's you,
Mona managed. To the most famous face in the world.
Yes,
Angie said, her eyes on Mona's face.
It seems to be.
Come on, Molly said, her hand on the star's shoulder. Get in. Your Martian spade will be waking up already. She glanced back at the helicopter. It looked like a big toy sitting there, no lights, like a giant kid had put it down and forgotten it.
He'd better be,
Angie said, climbing into the back of the car. You too, hon. Molly said, pushing Mona toward the open door.
But, I mean, move!
Mona climbed in, smelling Angie's perfume, wrist brushing the supernatural softness of that big fur.
I saw you, she heard herself say. On the vid.
Angie didn't say anything. Molly slid into the driver's seat, yanked the door shut, and started the engine. The orange hood was snugged up tight, her face a white mask with blank silver eyes. Then they were rolling toward the sheltered ramp, swinging into the first curve. Down 5 levels like that, in a tight spiral, and Molly swung them off into aisles of larger vehicles under dim green diagonals of light strip. Parafoils, Molly said. You ever see any parafoil gear up the Envoy?
No,
Angie said. If Net Security has any, they could be upstairs already. She swung the car in behind a big long boxy hover, a white one with a name painted across the rear doors in square blue letters.
What's it say? Mona asked, then felt herself blush.
Cathode Cafe, Angie said. Mona thought she'd heard that name before. Molly was out there opening those big doors, pulling down those yellow plastic ramp things. Then she was back in the car, reversed, put it in drive, and they rolled right up into the hover. She stripped back the orange hood and shook her head to free her hair. Mona, you think you can get out there and shove those ramps back in? They aren't heavy. It didn't sound like a question. They weren't heavy. She pulled herself up behind the car and helped Molly pull the doors shut. She could feel Angie there in the dark. It was really Angie. Up front, strap in, hold on.
Angie. She was sitting right beside Angie.
There was a whoosh as Molly filled the hover's bags, then they were skimming down the spiral ramp. Your friend, Molly said. He's awake by now, but he can't really move yet. Another 15 minutes. She swung off the ramp again, and this time Mona had lost track of the levels. This one was packed with fancy cars, little ones. The hover roared along a central aisle, swung left.
You'll be lucky if he isn't waiting for us outside, Angie said.
Molly brought them to a halt 10 meters from a big metal door painted with diagonal stripes, yellow and black. No,
Molly said, taking a little blue box from the dash compartment. He's lucky if he's not waiting outside. The door blew out of its frame with an orange flash and a sound that slammed into Mona's diaphragm like a solid blow. It crashed into the wet street in a cloud of smoke, and then they were over it, turning, the hover accelerating. "This is awfully crude, isn't it?" Angie said, and actually laughed. "I know," Molly said, intent on her driving. "Sometimes that's just the way to go. Mona, tell her about Pryor. Pryor and your boyfriend. What you told me." Mona hadn't ever felt so shy in her life. "Please," Angie said, "tell me, Mona." Just like that. Her name. Angie Mitchell had actually said her name. To her. Right there. It made her want to faint. 34. Margate Road. "You seem lost," the noodle seller said in Japanese. Kumiko guessed that he was Korean. Her father had associates who were Korean. They were in the construction business, her mother had said. They tended, like this one, to be large men, very nearly as large as Petal, with broad, serious faces. "You look very cold."
"I'm looking for someone," she said. "He lives in Margate Road."
"Where is that?"
"I don't know."
"Come inside," the noodle man said, gesturing Kumiko around the end of his counter. His stall was made of pink corrugated plastic. She stepped between the noodle stall and another that advertised something called roti. This word worked in deliriously colored spray bomb capitals, trimmed with looping luminous blobs. That stall smelled of spices and stewing meat. Her feet were very cold. She ducked beneath a clouded sheet of plastic. The noodle stall was crowded, squat blue tanks of butane, the three cooking grids with their tall pots, plastic sacks of noodles, stacks of foam bowls, and the shifting bulk of the big Korean as he tended his pots. "Sit," he said. She sat on a yellow plastic canister of MSG, her head below the level of the counter. "You're Japanese?"
"Yes," she said.
"Tokyo?" She hesitated. "Your clothes," he said. "Why do you wear rubber tabi socks in winter? Is this the fashion?"
"I lost my boots."
He passed her a foam bowl and plastic chopsticks. Fat twists of noodles swam in a thin yellow soup. She ate hungrily, then drank off the soup. She watched as he served a customer, an African woman who took away noodles in her own lidded pot. "Margate," the noodle man said, when the woman was gone. He took a greasy paper-bound book from beneath the counter and thumbed through it. "Here," he said, jabbing at an impossibly dense little map. "Down Acre Lane." He took a blue felt pen and sketched the route on a coarse gray napkin.
"Thank you," she said. "Now I will go."
Her mother came to her as she made her way to Margate Road. Sally was in jeopardy, somewhere in the sprawl, and Kumiko trusted that Tick would know a way to contact her. If not by phone, then through the Matrix. Perhaps Tick knew Finn, the dead man in the alley. End of Side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.